Hi, everyone. I'm Jennifer Vine, President and CEO of the Education Foundation of Sarasota County and your host for Education Conversations, where we share ideas on education today and ways to help prepare students to thrive. Welcome, everyone, to a really special episode of our podcast. I'm coming today from Tallahassee, where I'm attending some of the legislative sessions that are happening, and I have an opportunity to talk to some very interesting folks. And I wanted to bring one particular person in that has such a great pulse on what is happening here in Tallahassee, particularly in the world of Florida politics. And certainly, we have a great interest in learning more specifically around the realm of education. So, interesting too. He's described as an anomaly on his website, and I do attest to this. So Derek McGee is the chief operating officer for Johnson and Blanton, one of Tallahassee's most respected lobbying firms. But the interesting piece about Derek, yes, and I'm sure you've heard this many, many times over. So he is not only a lobbyist, he is also the founding pastor at Bible-Based Church, and he's been preaching for over 25 years. I've actually never heard one of your sermons, but maybe I will today. That's an anomaly. So, yeah. Derek McGee, welcome to Education Conversations.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here. I really am.
I've just so enjoyed speaking with you and learning from you after all of these different years. I really have. And so I want to know first, and I'm sure our listeners do, is how did that intersection of pastoral ministry intersect with politics?
Yeah, so I actually was in college at FAMU. I actually was going to school to be a lawyer. That was really my intent. So my major was political science. Thought that was going to catapult me to law school. And then around my junior year of college, my desire to go to law school changed. I just didn't have the fervor anymore. And I really started feeling a tug at my heart. And I was with someone who said, it may be a calling to ministry. And sure enough, it was. And so I conceded to that calling. And I changed out and added religion to my major, political science and religion, started pursuing that. So I actually started a licensed minister in college.
Wow.
And then my first job out of college, I worked for Governor Jeb Bush, one of his agencies. And so my entire professional career, I've been in ministry. And I didn't know, honestly, Jennifer, that I was an anomaly. I didn't realize it was like a rare situation. So people are always surprised.
To be a pastor.
Pastor and be a lobbyist. Because people look at lobbying in a very negative connotation.
Right.
And I am... I'm very active at my church, and I do the lion's share of the preaching. So people are always very surprised by it. But yeah, that was the pursuit. And it's been amazing. It actually opened up a lot of doors. There's a lot of legislators who actually call me into their offices to talk and want pastoral counsel, which is very interesting.
Oh, and then they start telling you more than you even
exactly.
want to know. And you're like, wait, let's make sure we know the role I'm playing. That is so great. So maybe even as you spoke about kind of how people view lobbyists and you said they kind of have a negative connotation.
Correct.
You know, is there a truth to that or is that just a myth? You know, how would you describe your role?
I think there's some truth to it. I would argue that not every lobbyist is bad. There's a lot of us who really operate with integrity and really desire to do right. But, you know, the frame of lobbying gets a bad connotation because there are some, they'll do anything at any time to get the result they want, including be dishonest. I've been doing this a long time. This is year 24 for me of a mixture of public and private sector. I haven't crossed many like that. And there's some I have, but most of them I haven't. We all want to do right by our clients in that regard, but there are some. And I think really the federal look of lobbying has kind of spewed down the stage where from a federal perspective, there are people who have a strong opinion about lobbyists and what they'll do to get things done. That's not really how it is in Florida. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who are in Florida process realize it's one big circle, right? If you really want to stay in this process for a long time, if you burn someone today, you will definitely see them tomorrow. So we want to do right by everyone.
So you're also a dad to two kids.
Yes.
So you must teach them some of these value-based principles about don't
100%.
Burn any of these bridges.
Exactly.
It's so interesting because I do think there's so much truth to that. So you worked, starting with Jeb Bush.
Yes.
And then also for Governor Rick Scott,
yes.
Is that right?
So I worked for three straight governors. I started out with Governor Bush, his first term, toward the end of his first term through second term. And then Governor Chris, Governor Chris, I worked for 2 years for him, well, 4 years for him, but in two different agencies. And I went back inside the governor's office for Governor Scott. So I finished my government career, Governor Scott, end of his first term, and I went private sector after that.
Okay. And so what are some of the things you're seeing over the time that you started to venture during Jeb Bush's time to the present with just Florida politics in general? What are some of the things that you've seen have worked well? Mm-hmm. And maybe what are some of the things that potentially have become a little bit more I don't even say polarized, because that seems to be so much of what we speak about. But from your vantage point, what have you seen over the course of the years?
I will tell you, from the very beginning of my career, the one thing I was taught early on is you have to read the bills. You have to know the rules. You have to actually respect every elected official, regardless of their ideology. At the end of the day, they got elected, and they have the vote on something. And so I always prided myself on reading every bill I was involved in, knowing the inside and out, but also knowing the argument of the opponent to whatever I was pushing, and then going to work every legislator. And this is back in the day, Jennifer, where legislators were getting in the Capitol 6 o'clock in the morning, 6:30. I remember meeting with then-Senator Mike Fasano one day at 6:35 in the morning, because he would get there very early. And they would meet with you, and they would ask you a lot of questions, but they had read the bill. One of my great concerns I've always had about supermajority is why it's great is you kind of lose that relationship, right? Because you go into every room knowing where the votes are end up being. So there really isn't that level of depth when it comes to policy. That is one of the things that I've seen that has changed over time. I think also what has changed over time really is appropriations has taken a larger role. I'm a guy who loves policy. But our budget has grown so much. I remember when Governor Bush was governor, he proposed a $50 billion budget. And people went ballistic, thought he was growing government. And people pushed back, they questioned them. Now we're looking at $115 billion, give or take. Right, that shows you how big our state has grown over these years. I think also with term limits, right, you, when you finally get a member where you need them to be as far as their knowledge on the process, they term out. So you're having to always really grab hold of members as they're running and as they get here throughout the entire process. That's important. The one thing I would tell you that's been consistent is the power of the executive branch, the governor's office. The entirety of my career, Republicans have been in charge of the governor's mansion. My colleagues at the firm, they go back to when Democrats were in charge. So they have a comparison. I do not. The entirety of my career, Republicans have been in the House, the Senate, the governor's office, in control, the cabinets. And so what I'm seeing really is, no matter how popular Governor Scott was, Governor Bush were, and they were, Governor DeSantis' popularity and power is unmatched. And to be able to see that. Lastly, I will tell you, I worked for Governor Scott when he had supermajority in the legislature. So I've seen that. It's beneficial, but it's also task-oriented, right? Members expect you to get things done, and they want you to get things done where they can actually feel the impact and the benefit of the result. And I think there are times where we get so caught up in the bickering and the back and forth that we forget for the entirety of 60 days, people want to see you advancing things to the finish line that's going to actually benefit their lives and their livelihood. And I think that part's important.
So you mentioned the power of the governor and also the power of the supermajority. And so I think in this session, and again, you're the expert, not me. I'm just a, I'm on the sidelines watching. I've got my toe in the water as we're trying to seek some appropriations. What I'm observing is that the Speaker of the House, Danny Perez, is trying to, and maybe even the Senate President, they're coming back and they're being, they're tempering the power, pushing back somewhat on the governor right now, and using that the supermajority actually can kind of hold it back. Is that a fair observation?
I think that's, I think it's fair. I'll tell you, it's been interesting because for 6 years, the governor really has asked and received. And I don't fault that, right? I mean, every governor is known, no matter whether you like them, you dislike them, they're known statewide. Right on there through Governor Scott, no matter what you feel about him in Tallahassee, as you went downstate, people recognize the governor before they recognize anybody else. Governor DeSantis has always had a bold agenda, and I commend that, right? Because he ran on a platform. We have to give results on the platform. And so these incoming presiding officers and Senator President Albritton and Speaker Perez came in with the mindset of let's reestablish the three branches of government. Right, where we really are the ones that are passing the bills and actually putting together the state budget and passing the budget and then sending it to the governor versus us being told what to do. And in order to do that, there is a tug of war. There is a trying to pull from one and reestablishing the other. Same party, right? And so I've always argued when you have supermajority, you end up fighting over three P's, right? You're fighting over power, position, and partisanship, right? And so at the end of the day, I think they all want the same thing. It's just how you get there. And so in order for them to reestablish legislative branch as being a powerful broker and a powerful partner, you have to be in the pull back what's been established for so long. At the end of the day, I think they still get to the finish line together. I think the press loves to write about it. Having been in this process, I'm seeing some of the stuff that takes place. But I'm not naive to assume that they won't get to the finish line and be able to drop the hanky together and say we win.
Right.
But
right.
I think it is interesting because this tug of war is also the governor's last 2 years.
Right.
So the question is, you know, they're doing this because the governor is lame duck. I will end by saying this, Jennifer. This is the first governor I've ever been around in my years of doing this where he's not the definition, the true definition of a lame duck, right? Normally at this time, they're kind of coasting out. They're just kind of keeping the ship in the middle of the water. Governor DeSantis is actually
activating.
Still boldly and activating and pushing a bold agenda to the very end. And I think Floridians expect that when you vote him in. And so it's been very interesting that he's not thinking about the next job or the next thing. He's really locked in on the here and now. And I think that's also part of the tug of war as well.
That's interesting. And then going back to the budget, you said it's now ballooned up to about $150 million. Yeah. So is the legislature looking at the budget in a more conservative approach because of some things, uncertainty in the economy or any of other conditions that are causing them to be a little bit more reticent to be giving any of these special appropriations and extra funding? Are you seeing that?
I am. Let me also, for fact checking, it's about 115. So if I said 150, I apologize.
No, I may have heard.
No, I may have said it too. So let me just make sure. But I will tell you that the economists have continued to say that while we're doing well from a budgetary perspective, Florida has doing coming out of COVID. I mean, we've done an amazing job in comparison to other states. What economists are saying is, however, you know, really start reining in spending and appropriating because we are nearing pre-recession. We cannot continue as we've done. And so coming into this session, especially the speaker has been saying it's going to be House going to have a very lean budget. We're going to do a lot of cuts. And when you hear that, people get really, really nervous. So what does that look like? Mm-hmm. And the overall concern is in about 2 years, they're going to start really seeing Florida look different. Now, some will argue that economists always say we're getting close to pre-recession. Fact of the matter is the legislature is coming in saying we got to be way more disciplined. The benefit we had over the years is we had a lot of federal money coming in that afforded us to do a lot of great things and use those monies, not state monies. But those monies are now, for the most part, gone. Right. And so now you have to look at state general revenue and other things of that nature. What does that look like? And I think from our budgetary perspective, you know, there have been some programs that really have benefited. I think member projects, for example, we looked at a whole lot differently now. The projects that really make it to the finish line are the ones that actually can point to other dollars, right? Matching dollars, whether it's local dollars, philanthropic dollars. They're no longer 100% funding anything.
Right.
There's a time for that. The challenge with that, though, is we saw when we hit recession of 07, 08, all those projects got defunded because they could no longer maintain doing that. So now they're asking those questions of how much money you get from your local government, how much money are you getting philanthropic dollars, are you shovel ready to do this new building, those things. And so any and all persons who are looking at appropriations, what I will tell them is you may not get the dollar amount you want or you're asking for. I always tell clients, look at it through three tiers, right? Ideally, number one, so my ceiling, this is what I really want. My negotiating rate, this is what I can deal with. And in my back pocket, I can't go below this number if I really want to be able to show an ROI. You got to have those scenarios because at any given point, you may go from asking for $1 million to end up at $500,000.
Right.
And what can you do with that? And we're at that stage in this process because the budget is going to be so tight. We got to be got to be mindful of how they appropriate those dollars.
That's fair. And then what specifically are you seeing kind of as the policies are being created, what is coming out as the top issues specifically in education?
Oh, that's great. So we're still looking at, so HB 1 passed a couple of years ago. It was the big school choice bill. You should expect this session, there will be legislation from both sides, the House and the Senate, to continue, as they will say, to still try to correct some of what they felt wasn't done with HB 1. What I mean by correct is through implementation, they're realizing there's still some questions being asked or there's still some challenges. So how do we refine that? And you're going to see that both being done in both chambers. Absenteeism is still a major, major concern. Representative Dana Trabosi out of Fort Pierce has been adamant about this. There are students that are not accounted for since the return back to school from COVID. And so absenteeism is a big deal, and it's a concern because when you do the student count in October and February, for example, right? Are we double counting kids because they may be now being a private school? Or have we just lost kids altogether, right? Mm-hmm. So absenteeism is important. You still have the matter that's going on with DEI, with woke and things of that nature. That conversation is continuing from a few years ago. So we're seeing that as well. I think you're going to see a lot happening in higher ed more than you see in K-12. And then also early learning, right? You're starting to see a little bit more attention given to early learning through school readiness and things of that nature. So education and healthcare are the two largest budgetary silos and the two largest expenditures, right? Healthcare being first. So every year there's going to be education piece. But with school choice, it's a continuance of what that looks like. Now, granted, you have, you know, those who are public schools will argue that you're continuing to almost defund public schools. What does that look like? But I will tell you, almost 3 years later, HB1 implementation is still top priority. The last thing I'll give you in education is there is a major conversation, almost a move afoot to do more in virtual education now, giving that a chance, that the scholarships now be used for part-time or full-time virtual, becoming way more of a conversation because you want to give parents full slate. Same with homeschool parents, right? Like, what does that look like? So all those things are still on the table. But how do you appropriate, right? How do you do this with the FEFP? So that's the continual conversational piece we're seeing out there.
When you speak about the kind of putting the refinements, if you will, back on the vouchers and the HB1 expansion and everything, are you seeing bipartisan conversations going back to, you know, some on the maybe the Democrat leaning side want to see more accountability measurements and seeing what the limitations are, whereas you see on the Republican side, they probably want more of the expansions of choice. So are you seeing bipartisan conversations taking place, or because of the supermajority, Republicans rule and what Republicans want to have happen is going to be implemented?
Great question. So I think it's more the, I think the latter will win out, but I will say this. I must give kudos to both the presiding officers, right? They really have at least been showing the desire to have a bipartisan conversation. Florida is a school choice state. There's no way around it, no matter how people feel about it, to be true. The challenge for HB1, if you talk to House staff, for example, is they argue because of how fast it's grown and the demand after the HB1 with removing the caps, predictability is very challenging. How do we predict and maintain control of the budget as it relates to what we are appropriating the amount of dollars? And so I think that's really leading the conversation. There's always going to be a discussion about, you know, public schools and what does that look like? Teacher pay comes up in that regard. What I'm hearing more of is the supermajority conversation as it relates to implementation, as it relates to, because they're all getting calls from their constituency, right? And so how do we make sure that we as a legislature are making it very clear, the expectation, clear on the reporting, clear on the ROI. We're really monitoring the monies that we are appropriating, those type of things. I don't see this as a, if we're giving more to school choice, we got to give some to public schools. I'm not seeing that type of a conversation. It's really more of, are we really implementing what we intended in HB1? If not, what do we need to be doing? And so there's been several iterations. We used to call it a glitch bill, right? You come in and try to fix the glitches. I don't think you ever do a glitch bill in education, especially school choice. I think it's always substantive policy. And so you're kind of seeing that play itself out. And I think you'll continue to see this play out over multiple sessions because it's ever evolving. The demand for the scholarship is almost at record level, if
it
not
sure
record
is.
Level.
So. Yeah. Isn't it over like 400 million or something like that?
Yeah.
It's been
the wait list is just amazing. People really are interested in it. I'll also tell you, you know, with I use the word heightened. I don't have SAS in front of me, but there's been a heightened, you know, parents looking because of various things, right? Whether it be bullying incidents or, you know, parents are reimagining education for their families because some of them are now traveling and they want to be able to do other options. I mentioned virtual earlier, or to the point where they're just looking around and realizing that they want to be able to be homeschool parents now.
Right.
What do those options look like? And so all of that now have parents looking at that the educational choice options and asking certain questions, which is why I think you're always going to be evolving in the school choice conversation because you're always trying to consider. One model, Jennifer, is hybrid schools, right? There are kids who, you know, go to a brick and mortar for a certain amount of days and they're at home the other days. What legislation really doesn't speak about that as they wanted to. So you always evolve and try to meet those new changes.
I think the whole innovation that we were just having another conversation about just where the uncertainty is right now in public education.
Correct.
And yet there's so much opportunity and to innovate. I'm actually excited and hopeful of how we can reimagine education because we've had so many pervasive, lingering barriers to us really hitting the marker that we're wanting to. So even though we've been having some incremental improvements, so we're really wanting to see that. I'm personally excited about what the opportunity holds. So what about though, and I don't mean to stay on this topic so long, but speaking about HB1 with the, you know, the choice, what about the money that follows it? Because I've heard even from like our own school district, you know, so a family chooses, the money follows, it goes out, then they decide, well, that wasn't really a great fit. They come back to the school district, but the money doesn't follow quite at the same rate and pace as the student is traveling. Yeah. How do schools manage with that? And is that policy being discussed at all?
Man, that's an amazing question, because I'm hearing that a lot more as well, just in normal conversations and education wing of things. And that is a major argument, right? And there's a major concern. Again, talking about predictability or just student count, right? Is how do you... How does the department keep their hand on that child who, I'm going to use the word bounce, right? They bounce back and forth for whatever reason,
right?
Is how do you do that? I'll tell you, conversations are being had. What does that look like in policy? I'm not certain. I know there's going to be education conforming bills. I'm assuming, without really having any facts, they're going to address that. But I will tell you that is a concern. Again, when you're trying to predict how you appropriate dollars, you're trying to play every scenario out. And you will see that, right, where a parent or parents pulled their child out, put them in this option, got them there, realized this was not good for their child. They pulled them back in for varying reasons. And from a state perspective, you're appropriating dollars, you mentioned, to follow that child. Well, that child keeps moving. How do you account for that? And so when I mentioned earlier about absenteeism, it's not just we completely lost a child as much as that child could it can be accounted for. Child may be in two different rosters, right? May be on a public school as well as a charter school or a private school option in that regard, and no one knows it. Now you're paying twice. All those things are being talked about. I do believe they're going to try to do something this year. They have to do something, because this is not a one-off situation. They're seeing this happen more and more and more. And that's a great concern, So I definitely think something's going to play out. I don't know what it looks like, truthfully.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it. It may be over multiple iterations, but they have to do something, because they're seeing it a lot more and hearing about it a lot more as well.
Yeah, because I think trial and error. I mean, that's
correct.
What we're all...
Correct.
Because we're all trying to seek the best fit for our child.
Correct.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. Okay, so one question we're getting a lot of, and I don't know if you're getting this here in Florida, but with everything is happening with the United States Department of Education and the changes therein, whether it means what's happening and how can education actually be served, how can students be served without a United States Federal Department of Education? And the second part of the question is, and then what happens at the state level?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you have the crystal ball or anything that you can give us insights on.
I will tell you, I'm hearing this come up more and more, and not just in education, but education is one I work in a lot, because no state has really had to consider a situation where you're not getting any federal dollars, right? Now, if you look at it from the federal perspective, what the White House is saying, they basically want to give the power to the states, right? And that sounds great. The challenge, however, is no state has positioned themselves to 100% have to fund education, right? If you do that, you have to make a lot of changes. And so we're nearing the juncture in our session where they're going to start putting together their own budgets, rolling those things out. You're going to see a lot of, when I mentioned earlier about a tightening of the budget, part of that's because they're having to leave room to consider what happens if USDOE is completely abolished. Like, we now have to take over that. I think that's a phase-out approach if it does happen, but also states now have to start taking on way more responsibilities than they had to take on before. They don't have that federal partner to play into it. And so that plays out, but also there's a lot of questions without enough answers given as well. And so what I've been saying to a lot of people in conversation across the variants of this, talking about DOGE in general, but even with USDOE, is you should prepare for the realization that even if USDOE is not completely abolished, it's going to be a drastic downsizing. And that downsizing federally becomes a major responsibility on each state, to the point where now you have to really start looking at, what do we fund? How do we fund? Redefining what is need, what is priority, what is focus. I would argue from Florida's perspective, I think Florida's always been the leader when it comes to education, especially from a choice perspective. So I think we will adjust decently well, but I think every state's going to have some level of an impact. And what I would say for Florida education is while we're seeing a lot of Floridians occupying roles in D.C., we're not going to be exempt from whatever that bump in the road is. I talked to several legislators, Jennifer, and even in the education arena, and most of them don't know what to do. They're really trying to figure out. They're hoping to get answers. The president put together a council of governors. Our governors are part of that council. One of the visions is to give them real time, intimate time with the president to have conversations, get updates, and kind of share concerns. So the hopeful that actually produces an opportunity to really get better understanding on what's going on, because we're in active session. We have to position ourselves for whatever the outcome ends up being. And so playing out all those scenarios, I don't think Florida is exempt from having to make some tough decisions. I don't think that at all. But I do believe that because we've also done really well with putting money away in the rainy day fund or in surplus dollars, that whatever the immediate impact is federally, we can adjust to that. For the time being, to buy us some time to make those adjustments. But we're not exempt from feeling some of that pinch.
Wow, that's really insightful. And so kind of from my vantage point, what I'm hearing is that things like the entitlement grants, which are like Title I, Title IX, all of that, that those would just be shifted to maybe a different department in Washington. Correct. And what you're then saying is it will flow then to Tallahassee. Tallahassee needs to look at a redesign of a funding model, and then from there it will go down to the local community.
Yeah, so one of the things I've been hearing, Lisa, they really want to give more power to states.
Yeah.
I know in Florida, Governor DeSantis has been talking about this since when President Biden was in office. He wanted to have way more control in his own state. And so you're starting to see that. You're going to definitely see that some shifting of what USDOE does to other departments for the most part. But I definitely think every state will be have an expectation that now you need to position yourself take some ownership into these things where now you're no longer getting, let me give an example in healthcare. In Medicaid, there are areas where it's a 90-10 match, right? State puts up 10%, government, federal government is 90%. When you start making those changes where now the state having to put up 20%, 40%, 50%, they've never had to do that before. So making those adjustments is going to be very, very important. And the constituency of your state will start filling those things as well. So how do you buffer that impact for as it become immediate? And so these things are being talked about. What's interesting is I don't know how you completely abolish USDOE. I think you definitely downsize it and really start making it very lean, which I think was one of the focuses is. But I think the grants that we've been used to pulling from, those dollars, all those things, we may start seeing those things get less and less appropriations and less priority. And now it becomes more of an onus on our state to figure out, do we try to maintain that or do we do away with it altogether as well? And those are some scary conversations.
Those are so interesting. And even the Florida education, the funding formula, that has been in place since like 1973.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would argue, you know, it might be time to look. I don't know.
And honestly, Jennifer, that part of this whole exercise, truthfully, is that what you just said, though. It's less about abolishment and more about, you know, again, let's use the word again, reimagining, right? Like we've done things for a long time the same way. There's actually no harm in stepping back from the table and saying, okay, is there a better way to do this? Can we think about a different manner? Is that the right approach? All those things are a part of that conversation. It's scary because it's not just one department. It's across all things in D.C. at the same time. But I think what it's allowing, though, is states that have visionary leadership, it's allowing you to really start thinking about what does your state look like in the coming years and what role do you want your state to play in the here and now and preparing you for that later?
Wow, this is really such an insightful conversation. It really is so insightful. And so for our listeners, I think it's important to also know that our legislative session is in effect for like 60 days. They get 60 days to figure a lot of this out. If not, they're called back to special session. And they balance the budget every year. And do you happen to know like how large that fund is? And I say trust fund, but I'm not sure if that's the right word. But what's that like reserve? What's the terminology for? Florida uses, and it's a very robust reserve.
So we call it a rainy day fund,
Rainy day fund.
And we use that just because it really goes back to because we had so many hurricanes here, right? It's putting away monies. So when we always did the surplus dollars, the rainy day fund, it was always used where, you know, when session's out, how do we try to get back to a heartbeat when you get hit by multiple hurricanes? And the rainy day fund was put in place. So again, I mentioned earlier that Florida has really recovered. I would argue the faster than any other state in the country post-COVID. And so we've been able to put a lot of money away in rain day fund. So when we have a hurricane that has major impact to our state over multiple cities and multiple counties, right, the legislature may come back in for a special session. But part of that really is giving the authority to the governor to be able to draw down money from the rainy day fund to go toward the repairing of roads and helping with insurance, helping with infrastructure. And so that's what the monies really are for. The monies have never really been used. I should probably say never. The vision has not really been about, you know, plugging in temporary gaps as much as really trying to recover from major catastrophic impact. And so, you know, we're I would argue near $20 billion. Mm. I may be actually a little light on that number, but we're sitting very, very pretty. Mm-hmm. We would be okay for a good while if we did right. And every year, part of the balancing of the budget, and this is for the listening audience, the only responsibility they have when they come to Tallahassee is to pass a balanced budget. Everything else is icing on the cake. They always make sure that they take into consideration putting a certain amount of money, $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 million in that fund and always continue to grow it, because we're always vulnerable for major impact. And we're being told already from our experts in the environment, in the emergency management arena, that we should expect another active hurricane season come June 1st, right? Sure. And so you always keep money set aside. And those monies were not thought about for the dissolving of a federal department and having to take on that. This was more for natural disasters and how do you do those things.
Well, and do you know if there's flexibility of redefining what a rainy day would be?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Because some may say this is a rainy time. I don't know. It's certainly a matter of perspective for sure.
Very true.
And then help me understand, did Governor DeSantis also speak about relooking at your property taxes?
And
I only want to know more about that because our property taxes are also tied to our required local effort.
That's really good.
That is tied to our funding for public education. So where is that kind of sitting right now?
So when we think about it, the governor has been talking openly about the elimination of this, right? He's been on social media. He's been in speeches talking about this. You've heard little to nothing from the legislature on this, right? Because it's not one of those things you can just easily do.
Sure.
The governor's thing is, because the argument is there's no comparison, there's a comparable way to replenish the money if you lose it, right? The governor's thing is we could figure out how to plug in those holes and replace those dollar amounts. It's going to be interesting because this is a bold idea. This is a huge amount of money that also has an impact all the way down to local government.
Yes.
Right? And so you can't just make a decision like that without really taking on consideration of the domino effect it will have in our state. And I think what the governor is doing, again, his last 2 years, you know, he's not coasting out of here quietly. He's being very bold on trying to be aggressive about doing things. And he feels like this is doable. Now, you need partners. Mm-hmm. This is where you need the House and the Senate to work with you on that. And they've been fairly quiet. I would argue they've been loudly quiet on this topic,
That's
right?
A great
they've been staying away from it. Because it is if you show any interest, the pressure gets added on the more to do something about it. And it's not something you can do over 1 year. You got to really have a plan in place.
Gosh. Okay, so my last question is, what did you preach on this past Sunday in light of everything going on? What has been your message at church?
Yeah, so I did Psalm 150, right? Just kind of talking about that. I did a comparison to a symphony orchestra, right? Because that song talks about the varying instruments that's supposed to be used to bring glory to God. And actually, my sermon title was It All Works Together, right?
Oh.
Every instrument... If you ever go to a symphony orchestra, no one goes there to hear one musician play. You come to hear the entire sound, and they all come together to make one sound. And my argument also is the most important person in a symphony orchestra isn't the people playing the instruments, it's the conductor, because he or she has the power through one instrument. And so it's really everything that Psalm 150 talks about at the end of the day is if you have breath, you're supposed to praise God. And I would argue even in our process, right, at the end of the day, all this work is done for one goal, which is you got to pass a balanced budget.
Yes.
Otherwise, you got to keep coming back and keep trying again.
Well, you just made a good button on the end of our talk, and that is really we need to stand united.
Yes.
Because that's and
get so
I think
much more done.
I completely agree with you. Derek, it's always so wonderful
speaking with you. My pleasure, my friend.
Gosh, I just love talking with you. And guests, I don't know. I don't have a website to lead you to. All I can tell you is if you are interested in the work that Derek and many of these other lobbyists are doing, it's important to be engaged and involved in your local community. Certainly know your legislators because they are doing a lion's share of work that is often not brought to the forefront that goes beyond what we read in the media. But there is a lot happening. I think we all know that. And Derek, you certainly enlightened us today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, thank you all so much for tuning into this special episode right here from Tallahassee, Florida. It's so fun to be up here in this environment and see everything that going on. And if you want to learn more about the Education Foundation, you always can find us on our website, edfoundationsrq.org. And we certainly hope you'll tune into other episodes of Education Conversations wherever you listen to your podcast. So for now, everyone, this is Jennifer Vine signing off for the Education Foundation of Sarasota County.